Enterprise Digital Podcast with Ian Aitchison and Barclay Ray, navigating the ever-expanding service management maze.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, whatever. Welcome to yet another episode of the Enterprise Digital Podcast. I'm Barclay Ray, and I'm joined by Ian Aitchison once more. Into the trivia, Ian, presumably. How are you? You doing well?
I'm very well indeed, thank you, Barclay. Very well indeed.
Good. So that usually means that you're bristling and ready to go with some exciting, crisp, fresh, new trivia.
I am indeed. I was wondering when we're going to change the format of the podcast, where the intro is about the digital enterprise and the main section's about trivia, because it's getting so good. So here's this podcast's trivia. Let me ask you, Barclay, have you heard of Huygens synchronization? Let's start there, because this is about synchronization. It's fascinating.
I haven't. Perhaps our guest today might have heard of that, but I'll just go with a no. I haven't.
We'll ask our guest in a minute. I'll stick with you and me at this point, because Huygens synchronization, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, is the remarkable effect when you have multiple pendulums swinging at different rates attached to this same supporting mechanism. They will gradually move to absolute synchronicity. You might have seen this where metronomes and pendulums, they suddenly all gradually start moving the same way. Now, my trivia is not about that, but it is about a similar human version of synchronization. Did you know that recently a study published in Scientific Reports has discovered that there is another sort of synchronization, induction synchrony. And that's this week's trivia. Induction synchrony is the interesting fact that when people attend musical concerts, their responses tend to synchronize. Their heart rates, how much they sweat, their breathing speed, and their movement all starts to synchronize across the crowd. And it does more so where they have similar personality types. Isn't that fascinating?
I suppose my question would be, how on earth did they not find that out? I mean, did they go to Stormzy concert and...
Science, Barclay, science. That's how they found it out. The experimental method, science.
Well, let's see if we can all synchronize on this podcast, shall we? And get our various bodily functions working on the same level. Delighted to introduce or reintroduce James Finister back to the podcast. James, how are you? How are you doing?
I'm good. I can add something to Ian's trivia.
Go on then. Good.
It only works if the pendulums have a common beam that they're supported from.
Or sitting upon. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So it doesn't work if you've got two totally separate pendulums. Now, to get on topic for this session, your musical synchronicity thing applies to most people, but not to those of us who are neurodiverse.
Oh, is that right?
Who often lack that internal clock which lets us synchronize the real world. And I mention that because it's what I'll be talking at the ITSMF conference this year.
Oh, what a great topic. Maybe we should make that topic, the conference, the theme of this week's podcast. What do you think, Buckley?
I'd never thought of that, but now that you mention it, absolutely. That is very interesting. And I know that you post and talk about your diversity in a number of different areas, so that will be interesting. Yeah, I mean, I just one thing on that musical synchronicity, and nothing to do with the Police song as well. How can that have been measured in a musical audience of, I don't know, several hundred people? Are they all been wearing heart monitors, or
I'm scanning through the article now. Three groups, three live concerts, body sensors, respiratory belts, pulse oximeter, overhead cameras. Do you want me to carry on? Science, Barclay, science.
Yeah, okay. I just find it, I don't know, slightly odd. I mean, I know that the extent of it with what the sportsmen wear, and they can tell exactly where they are on the pitch and what their heart rate is. But I also wonder whether their synchronicity extends to their brain activity and what they're actually thinking about the music, because I do think that people experience music quite differently. And the fact that they've all kind of settled down to the same level of bodily functions is interesting. But anyway, we're not going to get into that kind of level of detail. Let's take a pause and then we'll come back and talk about our main topic for the day. Okay, it's great to have James back with us. It was a while. I think you joined relatively early when we started this, a year or two back. We also had a discussion on one of our other recent podcasts about where we've got to and where we've gone with that, because when we started, we were talking about enterprise service management, and it's kind of gone through a cycle, you know, the hype cycle thing of it's a continual cycle that keeps coming around. It doesn't go away. It keeps coming back and so on. So we're still here with all of that. We're really talking today, I think, about the things going on in the industry and events. We've got the ITSMF UK conference coming up. I know you're speaking at that, James. What would be your thoughts? And I know that you always have both some pre- and post-conference thoughts about your expectations. But what would you be looking for from that event this year, or what kind of messages are you hoping to hear and to discuss?
It's always difficult, isn't it? Once you've seen the program, which sets, I was going to say sets the agenda. I mean, obviously the agenda sets the agenda. but I think it does make you think, what am I going to go to? What am I going to listen to? What will interest me? And also, you know, hate to say it, not every session can be fascinating. Really sorry to hear that Ian's not speaking, because he's always such a good speaker. I think for me, there's a couple of generic themes which I'm interested in the industry exploring, and I think some of the sessions are doing that. There's obviously the whole mental health, mental well-being, inclusion, sustainability type sets of topics. And I think I was putting a presentation together yesterday about the future of service management, and I think there's a very strong element of the topics we've always cared about, certainly the three of us I know have always cared about, but we've never brought them up front and central. But, you know, service management, as we all know, is a people-centric activity. So I think people topics are key for me. I would like to have some interesting conversations there around the whole people issue, ethics, sustainability, generational differences. I don't think there's a... Is there a session on that? I know there's a session about women in IT as well, and also Lucy Banks from Barclays. I wonder how she got to work with Barclays with a name like Lucy Banks. On women in IT, and again, I think, you know, that sort of thing is important. Interestingly, I think it's a good thing, is although the likes of Akshay and Roman are doing some sessions, I noticed that ITIL as such, I don't think it appears in one. I think it appears in one session title this year.
Just in defense of Shay there, he's not really involved in that anymore directly, although he still likes to be part of it. Roman, I know, is doing another ITIL session, and I'm actually doing something on some of the research that's coming out. So there's a couple of things, but I take your point, and it's kind of, I think it's there anyway, that it's not at the forefront. Well, it hasn't been for a while. I think at most events, it's still there, but it's not, you know, it's not the be all and end all driving everything.
Yeah. It's almost like a given, isn't it? And yeah, I mean, I know there is a session on ISO 20000, quick plug for ISO 20000, because I'm involved in it. But yeah, is that what modern conference should be talking about? Because we should know that stuff. A conference is for exploring, I think,
new stuff.
Yeah, exploring new stuff, exploring ideas, and having conversations with people.
Mm. It's very much, I think, all conferences are obviously about learning new things. I have this funny theory as well, that when you're attending these conferences, when you're sitting in a session or just walking around, you also find yourself coming up with ideas relevant to your day job as you're doing that as well? As you're walking around, you suddenly come up with all those extra inspirations that are not directly connected to what the speaker in the session is talking about, but it prompted you to think about something that drove you to write something down that led you to do something at work that you would not otherwise have done. So I find they're a great stimulant for any type of activity. I encourage people. We have a large organization of product managers where I work at Next Think. We have a large organization of product managers, and I encourage them to go to conferences for the sheer sake of going, because just by going, you're inspired, you soak up ideas, you get inspiration, you think of things, and some of the sessions may be a bit boring, but you come back with a big list of things you want to do when you get back into the workplace. They're great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think how many times I've gone to conferences, SDI, this one, some of the foreign ones, and I've missed a session because I've been in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and that conversation has been so useful that I've not. But, you know, it's why do you go to a conference? It's partly to hear the sessions. A lot of it is to meet people and discuss things.
Yeah, it's that human contact. You were talking about humans. It's a different sort of human contact to the one that you typically have in whatever your day-to-day routine is.
Yeah.
But it's a spark that may, there's a reference, but it's a spark that may light a fire. It's a different type of friction that comes from it.
No, I think the catch with that is, and I look back over my very long conference going career, you get out of the conference what you put into it in some ways. And I think many of us struggle to understand how to get the most out of the conference, or don't have the confidence to get the most out of the conference.
That's interesting, because you're right. It's a social situation where the more you engage with people that you may not know, the more you'll get out from it. But if you're uncomfortable in a social situation, it's quite hard sometimes to walk up to people and start those conversations. It's quite easy to sit silently in the back of the room, take some notes, and walk around without speaking to anybody. But of course, then you miss out.
Good point.
I'd sort of take the, I mean, I totally agree with everything that's been said, but I, again, have been going to conferences for a long time. So I don't really go to them to hear lots of presentations. I usually pick out beforehand two or three or four that I definitely will go to, that I think are going to be interesting and useful to hear, and then some others that I might go to, but the majority of the time is going to be taken up having conversations. And I think the thing that I think is different is because it is a slightly forced situation. You're put into a bubble somewhere with a group of people in the industry, many of whom that you will know, some of whom that you've never met and you don't know, and others who you may partially know or have some, and even those that you know, you may not have seen them for a while. But there's a whole number of things that can happen in that situation that wouldn't happen normally or naturally. It is a forced situation, but because you're all together, there are things that happen. So I can't remember the last time I went to a conference where something didn't happen that I wasn't expecting, or, you know, that wasn't in the normal way of, you know, the normal business of a conference. Like if I'm exhibiting, I expect to meet people and, you know, take their names and so on. But actually you have conversations in the bar or in the lobby or somewhere at breakfast that suddenly make you go, oh, I haven't thought about that. Or actually there's an opportunity here with discussing things with people that will actually lead to something. So it's that kind of happenstance, but slightly forced, as well as the interaction and just catching up with people, I think that really works. One of the things, though, that you said there, James, about that thing about missing presentations, I mean, I think we had that period where, you know, there were a lot of online conferences, and there are still more, you know, more of them, particularly the one-day events now, which weren't terribly successful on the social side, but they had actually still had the same kind of content, in some cases better. And then we really got into the on-demand side of it. So I think most events now will be able to provide that, whereas in the past they might not have done. I mean, any thoughts on that? I mean, having said that, I'm just trying to remember when the last time I actually went and listened to something on its own after an event, you know. You do.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. But, of course, sometimes it depends on sound quality. And I know after SITS, there's some comments that some sessions were recorded well, some weren't, which you know, we know is always an issue with SITS. I think, you know, don't you become selective, though? So if you know, if every single session, I don't know what the plan is recording sessions by Ray this year, you know, if every session was recorded, how many of them would you actually find the time to sit down and listen to? Maybe two or three. I don't listen to many, even if I'm on them myself. But yeah, they're useful. You know, not everybody can get to a conference, you know, particularly at the moment where we've got so many pressures on people's time, money, expenses, budgets. But there's still something about being in the room with people, isn't there? There's something about that interaction, even if it's just realizing how other people are reacting to what the speaker is saying. You know, you sit there sometimes and you see everybody else nodding and you think, oh, maybe I've missed something. You know, or sometimes you see quite a violent reaction to a session. And you think, oh, that's interesting. Why are some people pro and anti this? I think that's very hard to capture when we're doing so many online events. I still think online events have their place, but maybe more of a single topic. Whereas the whole point of the conference is there's going to be something you would never think of going to, but somebody else says, oh, I'm going to this one, come in with me. And suddenly you find something you didn't know you were interested in, you didn't know it was going to be interesting, and suddenly that's the session you take most away from. He says, looking through the program and thinking about one which might fall into that group.
It does depend where you are in your career as well, though. I mean, we're all fairly vintage.
Speak for yourself.
Ian's the youngest of this. I think you expect first timers and people new to conferences, they should be going and soaking it all up and listening to as many people as possible, but still, you know, using it as an opportunity to meet and greet and network with people. Just while it's on my mind, and I want to come on to the neurodiversity stuff in a second, but there's a new conference being announced for next year, which is the MSP event, which is a kind of clone of SITS, if you like. It's a SITS type event or a SITS event for managed service providers. I just wondered what you thought of that as an idea, either of you.
I guess it depends who's actually going to be the audience. Is it going to be a primarily sales event? You know, and SITS can get a bit salesy. I don't know. It's interesting. I had a long conversation yesterday about the future of SIAM. And obviously that impacted on the future of MSP. Yeah, long story. I still think that managing service providers is something we don't talk about enough. We don't do it effectively. If you look at the history of SIAM, as you know, I was quite instrumental in developing SIAM. What really makes it work got lost somewhere because we tried to make it turn into a set of practices and processes, blah, blah, blah. One thing, in fact, to manage a service provider, I'm going to sound a bit touchy-feely here, but you know, it's almost like, you know, dealing with difficult children. You know, you have to understand them. You have to emphasize with a managed service provider. You need to focus on that people aspect and not just the beauty shopping aspect of it. I think the idea of a show would be good. I guess we come back to how we make sure, or how they make sure attendees get the most out of it.
How would it differ for attendees from the usual SITS show? And for our listeners outside of the UK, SITS show is a well-established UK loosely ITSM event, ESM-ITSM event.
I think everybody involved would say, yeah, that's what they expect it to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. It's what it is.
Very good too. Yes, yeah, very entertaining day out. It's very good. Very different to the ITSM SMF event that James is at, which is, I would say, much more academic. That one, to me, has always been the tradition pillar of the industry. There's the awards dinner and the bow ties, and there's people that have been in the industry for some time, and there's a lot of wise people at the ITSMF event. It's a very good, established, almost traditional, and there's nothing wrong with that. Whereas the SITS show is more of a turn up with some popcorn, talk to some different software vendors, catch a few interesting sessions around the outside, have a good cup of coffee and go home without having to put your bow tie on at all. It's a different thing.
I'm that bow tie fun. I'm a scared bow tie actually to go with a beard and moustache, I've decided. I haven't worn a bow tie since I stopped lecturing 30 years ago. I think SITS is maybe more accessible as an event. I look around sometimes for the audience at ITSMF, and you know, no offence to ITSMF or to the members or anybody, and I see a certain type of person at ITSMF. Even though I'm in my 60s now, make me feel old, even though they're probably younger than me.
Must be bad.
They're there because they're established, because they're already senior managers, blah, blah, blah. Whereas I love at SITS that you get people who are there to start learning.
Hmm.
As opposed to for people who think they already know it all. Actually, something else I'll say about getting the most out of ITSMF as well is the worst thing I think you can do is go as a group of people from your own organisation and then never break out of that group. And I mentioned that because pre-dinners or the dinner table, you'll see people staying with the whole set of people they came with rather than taking that chance to speak to other people.
That's a comfort zone thing, isn't it? I mean, we all slip into that.
Oh, we all do it, don't we? I know that I'll spend most of my time talking to you and Stuart, Vance and Shane and... It's Roy, I can't remember.
Roy at the SDI event. He's coming to the SDI interestingly, I think, is another generational thing that's, you know, there is a difference between the ITSMF and the SDI ones, which tend to be, they have a lot more younger people because they are service, you know, there are a lot of service desk people that go. So the different, you know,
quite right,
cultures and different types of audience. Just on the Spark, on the MSP show, I think it's worth an idea worth trying, because I think they have always struggled with placement. We have struggled, I think, to define what the managed service industry, if it exists as an industry separate, is. And I don't think it necessarily needs to, but it has a different set of propositions, and the people that are working in it have a different set of criteria, even though we're talking about the same content pretty much. It's just from a different angle. So I think having an event for that allows that industry to express itself a bit more in its own terms, because when it does, you know, when people do come to ITSMF or SDI, they always have to kind of slightly adjust what they're saying, or, you know, we have to adjust what we're saying to make sure that we are inclusive of them. And that has always been a bit of a divide for me. So I'm quite looking forward to the idea of it that way. Shall we move on? I just thought it would be worth exploring a little bit about what you're saying. You're going to be talking about neurodiversity and you know, in terms of the industry and where we are. I mean, what sort of things will you be talking about, and what kind of angles will you be looking at? And just as a precursor, that I was at the UCHISA event this year, and there was a lady there who came from that area and spoke brilliantly, really, about, you know, just trying to express the difference in terms of how she saw the world. And I think the room was absolutely agog with, you know, just listening and taking that in. So I think it's a good time to have that kind of conversation at ITSMF.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's a big part of it. You know, trying to understand what neurodiverse people go through, experience, how they see the world is vital. And to understand that not all neurodiverse people see the world the same way. You know, it is about diversity. There's not one neurodiverse experience. Different people have vastly different neurodiverse experiences and perceive it differently. And I think it's also about getting that balance right between, you know, is it a curse or a superpower? And I think, you know, even within, again, the neurodiverse community, there are some people who see it as a superpower. You know, Rob England thinks his neurodiversity is what makes him what he is. If I'm honest, maybe neurodiversity has made me what I am. But unlike Rob, I'd rather not be neurodiverse if I could have my life again. But hey, that's life. But I think the other thing is I've spoken about this a few sessions over the years recently. We value neurodiverse people very often in our industry because of some of the skills and viewpoint they bring to it. We're very bad at handling them when we need them to change or organization changes or skill sets change. And it's almost like, you know, what was once your superpower can suddenly become a millstone around your neck. You know, we've all seen the programmer who loved sitting on his own. I'm being stereotypical here, and I hate being stereotypical about the neurodiverse community, but you know, the lone programmer sat with his earphones on in a cubicle writing code, and suddenly we're going to adopt Agile, and that programmer is suddenly thrust into a world where human interactions, rapid change, all the things that some neurodiverse people find hard to cope with actually becomes key. And yeah, and I think that's a real shame. And I think as managers, you know, we have responsibility to look after people, as well as actually, in many cases, legal obligations to look after them in those circumstances as well.
Yeah, you're describing maybe the fact that in an organization, in any function, in a business, in an enterprise where you've got leaders of people and managers of people who are responsible for the ability of those people to work and be productive, those managers need to recognize that everybody is different and we all have different strengths and different superpowers and different weaknesses. And this is where, you know, matrix management falls over terribly, terribly. You can't treat people as little checkboxes on a big list. Good management recognizes people's strengths and plays to their strengths and nurtures and encourages people so they flourish and blossom. Whatever color and shape and form their personality is, they still blossom. And bad management and a bad workplace forces them into a different shape and causes them to do the opposite of blossoming. Wilt, there we are, forces them to wilt.
Yeah.
There's something there about that. It's about management, right? Really, it's about culture and management.
I think it's about management. It's about, you know, and if there's a lovely quote, I mean, I don't think it was original. I saw in a BBC program about neurodiversity where a manager said, look, if we make the world better for neurodiverse people, we actually make a better world for everybody. Because a lot of the things that neurodiverse people need to feel comfortable, actually we all benefit from. We just maybe don't make it as explicit, but we benefit from it or would like it. So, you know, things like a quiet workspace. You know, we don't all like working. Does any of us actually like working in a truly open plan office with hot desking all the time? I've never met anybody who really enjoys that environment. The other thing I do want to touch on in the session as well, though, is also that some of our customers are neurodiverse. And I think that's something we often forget as well. And maybe some of our more problematic customers in the service management world are people who are neurodiverse, who you know, we all know that caller who gets panicked because something simple isn't working. Maybe they're not just an awkward customer. Maybe it actually is a real issue for them. I don't know.
Empathy and understanding that people are different, and empathy is an important part of relationships with people. We often talk around service management, and as you started, James, it all comes down to people. And the outcome at the end is all about an impact on people. So empathy and relationships with people requires you to recognize people are different,
and you know, and not be perfect. You know, I know my own wife struggles with me being neurodiverse at times, but at least recognizing there's an issue, which is a genuine issue and is nobody's fault, nobody's problem as such, but it's just how people are.
I was just going to say, what do we think are the specifics in service management that would relate here? Because, I mean, all the things that we're saying are absolutely correct, and you know, we'd agree totally, you know, but in almost any area of work, are there any specific aspects of what we do in, and let's just keep it to service management, where we need to be more aware or where it's more apt or relevant to that discussion?
I think recognizing our user community and the fact that some members of it are neurodiverse it is important. And yeah, you know, I'm thinking back to working with Happy Signals on stuff. You know, as you know, Happy Signals try and measure satisfaction of different user groups. And to me, the neurodiverse is perhaps one community who have specific needs, which we could measure and see if we're meeting their needs specifically. I think there's issues here about how we use them on things like the service desk. And again, you know, I'm trying to be careful about stereotyping them. You know, you could say that many neurodiverse people make brilliant problem managers, at least in terms of identifying problems. What they're probably not so good at is selling solutions to those problems to other people, because, again, I'm stereotyping, I know, but you know, very often the answer to a problem is obvious to a neurodiverse person, but not to a neurotypical person. So I think it's about finding the right place for them in our service management world, recognizing that actually they have bring a lot to the table in that world. And I think actually, if I look around to my colleagues and the industry, in the same way that you and I can identify quite a few fellow philosophy graduates, I think we could recognize a fair amount of neurodiversity in some of the big names in IT service management. I'm not going to name names. But, you know.
Go on.
Rob England, you know, will admit it. So Rob, for example, myself, I'm not Karen Bush, who I'm interviewing me as part of a session. Her family has a lot of neurodiversity in it.
I'm not asking you to. I wasn't really.
I've got your name at number 8.
I'm beyond all. But I think the point was just, you know, are there specific areas or aspects particular? Because, I mean, there's obviously the stress thing and you mentioned the agile thing, and there's a lot more focus now. I do go to quite a lot of organizations where they have taken those things on board and they have got people in certain roles, and the whole trends analysis thing is one particular area that's, you know, go and give that person a big pile of data and get them to come back with something, which again is generalizing, but it's, I mean, a lot of the focus that I've heard of that in the last year or two has very much been about how people are actually, you know, that they are recognized and that they are understood in the workplace. And as you say, with the customer base as well. Okay, so I mean, that's something that you'll be discussing. I mean, one thing I did wonder whether there would be any, because there has been quite a focus on that in ITSMF the last couple of years in terms of women IT and stress in the workplace and various other things. I know people have done that. Claire Drake and Rosemary and so on have all been involved in those kind of discussions. So I think we will look forward to that. Just, I mean, in terms of rounding off, what do you think, what's your hope for what we do next year in terms of the industry? Because, I mean, we've been talking around a whole number of things for a while. We've got a huge burst at the moment around AI and so on. What's your closing thoughts as to, you know, what we're going to look out for next year?
So I would hold it up to advertise it again, but unfortunately my dog got hold of it. So I would show you my copy of High Velocity ITIL, but it got rather eaten by a dog. I think the next step forward from High Velocity ITIL is important. I think we've got to start thinking about what are the big themes. And for me, I've mentioned ethics, sustainability, AI. I think we're going to see governance come really back onto the agenda in the next year or two, partly driven by the AI issue. And I think, I mean, it's really a question for people like Ian to some degree. We've gone through a very long period, maybe 30 years of process and tool-led solutions for service management. And without shifting, without using the agile big A word, I tried to actually put this onto a mind map this morning. I came up with the term emergent, but it's emergent and it's contingent in that we do what works now, and if it stops working or if it works for some of our community of users, not others, we do it. The one size fits all, we implement a tool, we implement a process. I'm hoping we can get people to talk about how we can do things differently and how we can be open to doing things differently in real time to some degree. I mean, it's not easy. I don't have the answers, But I think that's what we see other industries doing. You know, we're seeing, you know, might I say that? I can't think of an example, can I? But yeah, we see retailers change what their retailing model is quite quickly.
Transformation.
This continuous transformation, is it? But that's too strong. I think it's evolution, maybe. Maybe it's evolution is the term I'm looking for.
Accelerated evolution, perhaps. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's also about experimentation. Yeah, it's about suck it and see. Yeah, something. I mean, Barclay knows, I think you know as well, Ian, I've talked about this a lot over years. You know, one of my pet hates, and I have many, the same metric being used as benchmark year after year after year, when that was actually yesterday's news and actually yesterday's figures aren't compatible with today's figures anyway. I've told this story a thousand times, but you know, when I was a statistician of the Met Police, I just stopped producing statistical reports for customers and waited till they came back to me and said what they needed now. And you know, what we discovered was we were spending 75% of our man time producing reports which went straight into the paper bin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's often the way. Work for the sake
of... I think your service... and service management's the same. Yeah. How much activity do we do in service management? Because we've always done it, because that's how we're taught to do it, that's the way to do it, not because it's what's effective.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tie together a few things that you said earlier, James, and that we referenced all the way back to events as well, connecting this up. You mentioned about AI, you mentioned about ethics, you mentioned about things changing very quickly. We talked about virtual conferences, and I think Barclay said he hadn't been to a virtual conference for a while. Total coincidence, yesterday evening, I was watching on YouTube a keynote session from a conference that had been published just in the last 24, 12 hours, something like that. Gartner's Symposium they do in Orlando. Great event. Been to it many times in the past. Brilliant. But they now publish their keynotes straight into YouTube, public, and everybody can see them. And they had one that was this keynote was all about, obviously, AI. And it was all about how it's going to change for CIOs and how it's going to change businesses and how CIOs need to be changing their strategy and their plans and how they can introduce that experimentation that you were talking about, and what they need to do for AI security and for AI governance. So it's amazing how the things we've talked about, so many of them came up in that session, which was a virtual session I watched, not present at the event, which is what we were talking about earlier. That's amazing. Synchronicity, everything connects.
Yeah, and okay, so I'm going to do a plug for a conference which isn't on our agendas. 9th of November in London is the BSI Autumn Standards Conference. Free to attend if you register. And I find it fascinating because although I'm involved with several ISO standards, BSI standards, in fact, I can't even remember what the list is of standards I'm involved with, AI, service management, governance, systems and software development. I'm sure there's a couple of others I'm on committees for.
They love you, James.
But I love standards events because I meet people from different communities. And you have conversations with them because you meet somebody who says, oh, I didn't know about sustainability. And you can have a conversation about sustainability and AI or sustainability and service management even.
Yeah.
So if you can get to that event free of charge, I really recommend it.
Good tip.
Absolutely. Recently did a Simon Wardley thing on sustainability. It was about 70 of us, and there was only a few of us that were in IT at all, and it was fascinating to hear different perspectives. Okay, James, thank you for that. I think we've talked around a few things. Ian summed them all up very nicely. I mean, you talked about emergent. I think convergent is maybe the...
Yes. Convergent, emergence. The
summary there that we've talked about, a whole number of apparently disconnected things, and actually they are all coming together as one.
Yeah, I'm just looking forward to everybody at the event wearing Fitbits so we can measure whether or not they synchronize their response to sessions.
Okay, let's look forward to that. Okay, let's synchronize our watches and take a pause there. Thank you. Right, so we've talked. I mean, fascinating set of different things in terms of the topics there, and we seem to come around to the point where they all do join up. So that's got to be a good outcome. Ian, I'm going to leave it to you as to whether you decide what sort of thing you're going to ask James.
Yes, well, we've introduced new.
We've got some new.
Oh no! Bear with me with my favourite extremely complex cocktail ready to go.
Damn! And I'm going to ask you a different question.
Yeah,
we've been asking about favourite podcast bar drinks now for 2 years.
That's nearly three.
200 years. Last time I tried something different and we went for sandwiches. So tell us, James, what would be your recommended podcast sandwich?
Ooh.
In detail.
I could probably post a picture of last Saturday's sandwich from a little cafe in Spalding, which was crayfish, smoked salmon and dill mayonnaise, which was rather nice. Obviously, I spent all my life on the road. And there's that moment when you're at the station, you're waiting for a train, and all you want is something just, I don't know, that energy boost or something. And for me, it's a chain tuna and sweet corn sandwich. Ooh. It's awful. It's disgusting. But sometimes it's just what you need. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Long card to play. Ooh,
okay. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I was saying in the last one that I don't like sandwiches that try to be a meal, you know, it's like lobster thermidor and, you know.
Oh, I mean, these are the best. I mean, yeah, I apologize to our American listeners, but just apart from the struggle of trying to order a sandwich in America without feeling like an idiot or a terrorist, I just can't eat them.
Yeah. I once asked a waiter to take it away three times because he had too much meat in it. And I just said, I'm not going to waste that. I don't know how many times he spat in it.
I hope we're all enjoying this week's sandwich podcast brought to you live.
Do you want to give us the cocktail as well or not? Or did you have one?
Well, the cocktail mostly consisted of a single malt with water.
Excellent. Keeping it nice and simple. Okay, James, thank you for that. Presume people can contact you, how? LinkedIn or where can they?
LinkedIn and now I guess james.finister@btinternet.com. If you want to email me,
okay.
I'm probably on things like Feds and so on, but I've lost track of all those alternatives to X.
We give up on Threads.
I still look at X, Twitter occasionally, but LinkedIn is the place to go. Thank you very much for joining. We will see you again, and we'll see you at conference or conferences in due course. Ian, thank you too, and we'll speak to you soon. See you next time on the Enterprise Digital Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.